You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
I want to welcome all of you to the first of what we hope is a series of discussions, events, projects on China-Russia relations. I should mention that this project is being carried out in the, again, for what we hope is first of many collaborative efforts between the China project and the Russia project here at OSI. And I see my colleague Lenny Bernardo in the audience. It is very exciting to have this opportunity to collaborate with so many talented Russia hands here at OSI. Let's begin. We have a very distinguished panel with us today. I've noticed it sometimes doing or attending various China and events, right? China and Russia, China and Africa. One, China is always first for some reason. I'm not sure why that is. It's never Russia in China or Africa in China. Two, you often find that the panel is overly populated by the people on the other half of the and. So it's overly populated by Africa specialists or Russia specialists. And the China hands are nowhere to be found. I'm not sure why that is, but we have avoided that problem today by getting three people who are deeply steeped in both countries. And we couldn't be luckier than to have the folks we have to speak with us on this important issue. I will give a brief introduction to all three speakers and then ask them to jump in with their remarks for 10 or 12 minutes, and then we will open it up for questions. I believe we're going to be turning first to Dr. Gil Rosman, who is the Musgrave Professor of Sociology at Princeton University. He has written widely on Northeast Asia, including China-Russia relations, and is a leading American scholar on this subject. Second will be Dr. Bobo Luo, who is the Director of the Russia and China Program at the Center on European Reform. CER, of course, a longtime friend of Open Society Institute. He has written extensively on Russian foreign and security policy and is particularly focused on Sino-Russian relations. Many of you may have seen his new book that is Axis of Convenience, Moscow, Beijing, and the New Geopolitics. Batting cleanup will be Dr. Liz Wisnik, who is Assistant Professor of Political Science and Law at Montclair State University, and yet another leading expert on China-Russia relations. She is the author of Russia, China, and the United States in Central Asia, Prospects for Great Power Competition and Cooperation in the Shadow of the Georgian Crisis. With those brief remarks of introduction, I'll now turn it over to our panel, and I'm very excited to welcome all three of you to OSI.
It's a pleasure to be here and to talk about Sino-Russian relations, which often have been misunderstood and not considered for their full importance. I majored in Chinese and Russian studies, studied both languages, and have been following this relationship for a long time. In fact, for 20 or so years, I traveled to these countries regularly and examined their views of each other and the course of relations, and always from the early 80s when the normalization process got going until today, one found a pattern of troubles. There are all kinds of specific problems to this relationship. It hasn't been going as well as the rhetoric suggested. But behind the troubles, there was a persistent pattern with brief interruptions for nearly three decades now of improved relations. And so the question is how to balance the evidence of problems with the record of improvement. And I, in the last few years, have not been allowed to go to China, cannot get a visa, was told today again, even though I have an invitation for a conference in Shanghai in May, that I won't get a visa. In the 80s, I had a five-year stint where I wasn't allowed a visa into the Soviet Union because of what I wrote about Sino-Soviet relations, so this is only fair play. But in my recent time, I've been trying to get at the big picture, to try to figure out what to make of the nature of this relationship in a broader perspective, and I've come from two points of view. One is to understand the strategic thinking towards Asia in each of these countries, and the other is to look at their national identities, to try to figure out what is the driving their approach to their bilateral relationship in a broader context. And so I'll start by giving my view of the current state of relations. And here, of course, the rhetoric exceeds the reality. There is a tendency to conceal aspects of their problems, some of their clashing interests. As was true in the 90s, politics is better than economics, which is better than cultural ties, and central relations are better than border relations. But nonetheless, there are powerful forces driving the countries closer. And I'm not sure that any of the anticipated factors that could interrupt this pattern are sufficient to suggest a downturn. The border issue, well, China and Russia have managed it much better than many expected, some in the early 90s. Central Asian rivalry, China has been sufficiently deferential and has a sufficiently strategic outlook on the importance of Russian relations to make that unlikely that that will become a very serious barrier in the foreseeable future. Energy policy, they're working things out, and indeed with the financial crisis, it looks like there is China has more leverage and there'll be more arrangements achieved. Arms sales, well, Russia is selling less and they have some serious problems, but I don't think that's a deal breaker. So what I would say in response to the book I've been reading, the really impressive work of Professor Lowe, is that I don't think this is just an axis of convenience, although like many bilateral relationships, it is that. I think it's also an axis of ideology, or at least overlapping worldview, that the overlapping worldview is powerful and that it will continue to drive them together in the foreseeable scenarios I see for the coming years, given U.S. foreign policy and other problems that exist. The main source of instability in recent years has been either Russia being so weak in the 90s that it depended heavily on the United States and was afraid of offending the U.S., or Russia getting so overconfident in the last few years that it was beginning to find ways of challenging China more directly. But now I think Russia's not likely to experience that overconfidence, nor that similar sense of weakness now that we have the Putin foreign policy having been well established. So I would say that there is likely to be China as the driving force, setting the limits to the relationship, not moving in a jerky way towards an alliance or towards a fraying of ties because of unpredictable and unreliable Russian behavior. And no other country likely to deflect this pattern. Indeed, I would regard North Korea's behavior in the coming period as likely to reinforce their ties, and Japan's behavior is unlikely to really influence the ties significantly. South Korea as well, with less room to maneuver because of the rising Sino-Russian ties. I don't think that anything special will happen there. I've also studied perceptions of these relations a lot, and I think they've become a lot less problematic, particularly focusing on the leadership level. And while academics in both countries will say a lot about the difficulties if you press them hard enough, I don't think that's as clear at the leadership level where they value this relationship and steer the images in the two countries. And indeed, the bilateral images have improved some, even though the year of China and Russia and the year of Russia and China, this public relations gimmickry of the last few years hasn't made any meaningful impact. A large part of the public relations factor is the weakening U.S. image, and that has given them more confidence of working together, both because of President Bush's unilateral approach, the Iraq War, and now the financial crisis. And I think Obama's more pragmatic and more engaged approach won't do the trick, because neither of these countries is really going to be receptive to U.S. idealism or to full-scale or increasing engagement. Both are driven by national identities and interests to remain rivals of the U.S., although in different ways. China more subtly, more long-term, and with a facade of cooperation that far exceeds the reality of what its intentions are, and Russia with more anger, more bitterness, and with more of a driving force in relations in Europe. I would also say that China's Taiwan issue, which it will not, even though things have looked much better recently and it looks like the issue has become much calmer as a problem of U.S. relations since Ma Ying-jeou was elected, will not be resolved. There will be many tensions over Taiwan ahead, is my prediction. Finally, the institutions ahead of us that exists, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the six-party talks, and so on, I think are generally understood to be instrumentalist groups, not very significant for driving this bilateral relationship, and useful to them, unlikely to fray, although not likely to get much stronger either. So to conclude, I would regard the increasing relationship between China and Russia, but not in a very substantial way unless that comes in response to particular U.S. actions, and there may be such actions because of the seriousness of the problems the U.S. will face with North Korea, Iran, and maybe Pakistan, that all of these reasons will bring China and Russia to a point where they will remember what happened during the Sino-Soviet split, how much they have to lose, and keep working together in a somewhat closer and a more substantial fashion while trying to cover up the clear differences that exist between the two.
Thank you. And Dr. Law, joining us from London.
Yes, thank you. First, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to participate in this discussion. And I apologize for my lateness. It's the appalling London traffic, but please accept my apologies. I thought in the next few minutes that I would concentrate on five broad areas. First, mutual perceptions. Second, the current state of Sino-Russian relations. Third, as in the blurb, the diverging views and interests. The fourth is the global financial crisis and Sino-Russian relations. And then finally, I want to just say something about the outlook, both medium and long term, for the relationship. So let's start off with mutual perceptions. And in many respects, I do agree with Professor Rosman. Russian and Chinese attitudes towards each other are certainly more positive, I would argue, than at any time in the history of the relationship. And these attitudes reflect and also reinforce the generally positive trend of the bilateral relationship in the post-Soviet period. It's fair to say that Russians, both elite and the general public, are impressed by the sheer speed and scale of China's transformation. And the Chinese, for their part, see a Russia under Putin that isn't the basket case it was in the 1990s. Nevertheless, I would argue that perceptions on both sides are principally characterized by ambivalence and mistrust. So if we go into it in a little bit more detail, let's look at Russian attitudes towards China. Yes, the Russians are impressed by the Chinese, but Chinese achievements are also a source of concern. They conjure up the image for many Russians, and you can argue about the rights and wrongs of this, and you can say it's irrational, but they conjure up the image of an increasingly assertive and potentially aggressive great power, and with specific ambitions in the Russian Far East. The Russians view the Chinese in the way they don't view the West as a long-term existential threat. Now, it's fair to say that there's a strong xenophobic element to such fears, a sort of the idea of the yellow peril, the teeming millions just waiting to bust across the border. More generally, however, there's a concern that China's rise will come, at least in part, at Russia's expense. There's already talk about, plenty of talk, in fact, about Russia being a mere raw materials appendage, a resource cow to China's rapid modernization. And there's also a concern that China's rise could equate to, well, in a way, Russia's marginalization from regional and global decision making. Now, I think it's important here to differentiate between the way Russia views China in large terms, as a strategic counterweight to the United States, which they see obviously as a good thing, and their rather more negative responses to Chinese living and working in close proximity. Now, I think the overall, the Russian attitude towards the Chinese, it combines all sorts of things: admiration, envy, xenophobia, apprehension, and funnily enough, almost a residual historical contempt. Chinese attitudes towards Russia. Now, the Chinese, of course, recognize that Russia is a different beast today than it was in the 1990s. Nevertheless, they hold it in quite often in a surprising degree of contempt. They see Russia as over-reliant on its natural resources, as unable to reinvent itself as a modern great power. In a way, they see Russia more as a lucky power than a great power. And they certainly look at it as second rate compared to the United States and even Europe. Now, they recognize that Russia under Putin is an important international actor. That's true. But they see it also as an important international actor in a largely negative, prophylactic, spoiling sense. They believe that its ability to affect positive influence, positive change, is limited both by its domestic weaknesses and also by what the Chinese often see as a rather confrontational attitude, approach to international relations. So what are the implications of this sort of these attitudes? Well, I think the problem is here is that this kind of mutual ambivalence is a major constraint on the development of the relationship. It really does constrain the potential of this relationship. And it also ensures that both countries look principally to the West for their key reference points, whether they're strategic, political, economic, technological, even cultural. So now the state of Sino-Russian relations. Well, I think overall the relationship, despite what I've just said, is essentially sound. And again, you can make the case that it's arguably better than at any time in its history, certainly better than in the so-called unbreakable friendship days of the 1950s. But fundamentally, this is a limited partnership, not a strategic partnership. In many ways, it's a traditional great power relationship. It's based not on empathy, but calculation. And I think it's significant that many of the achievements, for example, that Professor Rosman has identified, are not unequivocal. For example, yes, it's true the border question has been resolved. Yet the Russians constantly fear Chinese irredentist ambitions in the Russian Far East, at least in the longer term. It's true that there are no major bilateral disputes, but there's also little mutual trust. It's true that trade, for example, has increased tenfold in the past decade, yet it remains very, very modest proportion, particularly of China's trade, a mere 2%. There is some convergence on many international issues, but there are also important differences of emphasis. And yes, there are growing institutional and human ties, but I think very little at either the elite or public level. So we come to diverging views and interests, and really I'd divide them into four. I would say there's different perspectives, different styles, different priorities in the relationship, and growing asymmetries in that relationship. So different perspectives. Well, it's certainly true that partnership has benefited and received considerable impetus from a common opposition to the US or many US policies, particularly under the Bush administration. But it also seems to me that Moscow and Beijing have fundamentally different visions of a post-unipolar world. Now, what does Moscow imagine? It sees Russia as one of the three great powers in the world, as a kind of bridge between East and West. It strives to recreate the concept of great powers in various forms, whether it's the G8, the BRICS, kind of continental European consensus, UNP5, so on. And now that Obama is showing real interest in Moscow, in Russia, it even hopes to recreate a kind of bipolarity with the United States. Ultimately, the mechanism matters less than the final goal, and the goal is Russia's return as a great global power. Now, by contrast, I think the Chinese see this new world order, although they talk about multipolarity, but they see a multipolar world order as frankly a distant prospect, and that the United States will remain the sole superpower for decades. In the meantime, you've got to be practical. And that means not directly challenging the United States, American primacy, because it's not an achievable objective. And in not allowing partnership with Moscow to spoil its far more important relationship with Washington. Now, I think in the longer term, Beijing imagines a new bipolarity. But this is a bipolarity with the United States, and it needn't necessarily be one of strategic rivalry. It could be a strategic condominium. But either way, Russia would occupy a wholly secondary place in this strategic environment. Now, Moscow and Beijing have very different styles. Russia emphasizes geopolitical contestation. It promotes itself at every opportunity to be a great global power. It says, respect us. China, however, likes to use words like international stability, harmonious world, peaceful development, and it downplays its influence in the world. It says, we're not a great power. We're merely the largest developing country in the world. Now, Russia's style reflects a profound, I think, superiority-inferiority complex. And China's approach appears more diffident, but ultimately it is more assured and less neuralgic. Now, I think they have different priorities in the relationship. Russia wants a good relationship with China because it helps secure the Russian Far East and it acts as a strategic, it helps to, as the Russians would say, constrain US hegemonic power. But the thing is here, Russia sees China as a strategic counterweight rather than strategic partner. Now, for China, good relations with Russia are mainly important so that it doesn't have to worry about bad relations. It can secure its strategic rear so that it can focus on much more important priorities elsewhere, which are, for example, domestic modernization, reunification with Taiwan. In other words, Russia here is a niche partner, not a strategic partner. It's certainly important in some respects, but it's not absolutely pivotal. And I think, I understand Elizabeth Wishnick's going to talk about this, the Georgia crisis. Well, it seems to me that the Georgia crisis highlighted the limits of Sino-Russian consensus. But you know, the biggest weakness in this relationship is the fact that it's increasingly asymmetrical. We can just run through them quickly. The economic gap between the two is widening. The trade relationship is increasingly asymmetrical and unbalanced, heavily in favor of China. The energy relationship, despite what Professor Rosman says, is tenuous. In Central Asia, China and Russia are as much competitors as partners, because while they agree on the limit, on the need to limit Western and particularly American influence, again, they have no consensus on the shape of a future regional order. Because Russia ultimately wants to reassert itself as the leading power in Central Asia, whereas China aspires to a more even unbalanced strategic accommodation. And meanwhile, it doesn't want accommodation with Russia as globally, also regionally. It doesn't want it to spoil relations with the United States. And it seems to me that this conflict between Russia's geopolitical agenda in Central Asia and Chinese concrete interests is reflected in their very different approach to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Because ultimately, the SCO's main importance for China, for Beijing, is to facilitate China, to in a way kind of legitimize China's re-entry into Central Asia as a major player. And this is a goal that directly contradicts Russia's strategic agenda of leadership. And the result, really, is if we're talking about institutions, is that the SCO remains a very modest organization of very modest achievements. Now, longer term, the biggest asymmetry of all is that China's peaceful rise has major implications for Russian interests. Over time, economic power translates into heightened strategic influence, whether it's in Central Asia, energy relations, global decision-making. It also makes the Russians increasingly nervous about the long-term future of the Russian Far East. Global financial crisis, just very quickly. What the global financial crisis, it actually hasn't created anything new in the relationship. It's just reinforced certain truths. It's highlighted the disparity between the Chinese and Russian economies. One is pivotal, the other essentially marginalized. The financial crisis has also emphasized the extent to which the Chinese and Russian economies are dependent on the West. The crisis has also exposed the myth of Russian and Chinese economic exceptionalism. There is no alternative economic model, let alone a new economic world order. On the contrary, the crisis has highlighted the central importance of the United States. Basically, when the United States totters, the world shakes. That's certainly not true of Russia, for example. I believe that the so-called global multipolar order is a fiction, and that the so-called shift to the East has been much overstated. It's true that the United States has lost much of its authority, but it has not lost its primacy. The global financial crisis will, I believe, push Russia further towards the West. And it may also, in fact, I think this is highly probable, accelerate the trend towards a long-term strategic bipolarity between China and the United States. And that would leave Russia on the outer. So the outlook. I think the relationship, the bilateral relationship, will remain essentially sound in the short to medium term, by which I mean 5 to 10 years. As Professor Rosman has said, there's no deal breaker on the horizon. I think existing tensions and contradictions are basically manageable. But the longer-term outlook is uncertain, given the growing asymmetry in the relationship. And so, in my book, I argue that what the most likely long-term scenario is one of strategic tension. Existing fault lines will widen, and cooperation will become increasingly uncomfortable and ineffectual, although there won't be confrontation, in my opinion. The real problem here is that China's attitude to Russia, I think, will be one increasingly of indifference, and the Russians will naturally resent this. The West should not fear the so-called strategic partnership between Moscow and Beijing. You can argue that Russia may pose a threat, that China certainly poses an enormous challenge. But together, Russia and China are considerably less than the sum of their parts. They don't like to see the other do too well. This is, and this is why I call it an axis of convenience rather than, say, an axis of ideology. This isn't a relationship between two like-minded countries. The growing inequality of the relationship will push both Russia and China to engage more with the West. The Chinese, because that's essentially where the action is, and the Russians, out of fear of the Chinese. Now, in the West, we should appreciate a good, stable Sino-Russian relationship, because the reverse would be, the opposite, would be to destabilize not only Eurasian, but global security. Now, ultimately, the key question for the Sino-Russian partnership is not whether it challenges the West or whether it undermines the existing world order or seeks to create one. The key test is one of relevance. Can the relationship stand the test of time and rapidly changing circumstance? Thank you.
And,
thank you very much to OSI for inviting me. It's a very difficult task I now have to follow Gil Rosman and Bobo Lo after such provocative comments by both of them. I, too, was just reading Bobo Lo's book, and I found myself feeling the need to defend the strategic partnership, even though for many years I've always been one of the more skeptical analysts on this subject. But I think I take a middle ground between the two speakers. I think I share some of Gil's feelings about the overlapping worldviews. And I also share some of Bobo Lo's views about the mistrust between the two countries. But I still think that there is some substance to this strategic partnership. And what I want to do in my comments is to talk about this partnership in three areas. One, in terms of the bilateral relationship, and looking at the pluses and minuses. Second, at the multilateral dimension, looking at China and Russia and global and regional organizations, and then looking at the economic crisis and what that means. So I think what we haven't talked about very much here yet is history and how history has shaped the relationship between these two countries. And there was a song about the Sino-Soviet alliance in the Stalin era that was called Bratya Navyek, Brothers Forever. And I think that really captures how these two countries are with each other. They're together for better or worse. And when we think about the partnership and what is strategic about it, I think it bears looking at how the Chinese translate this concept. Because they have a much longer term for this relationship that translates as the good neighborly strategic cooperative partnership relationship, which is not very catchy. But what it does show is why the Chinese think this is strategic. For them, it emphasizes the strategic need for cooperation among neighbors. Because, for better or worse, they're located geographically across a long border from one another and have to deal with each other. Because the alternative is much worse. And this is at the root of Deng Xiaoping's belief about peace and development, that you need a peaceful environment for development. And Russians, having lost millions of dollars in defending this border, also agree with this need, too. Also, for both countries, the normalization of the relationship was a major foreign policy achievement. This is part of Deng Xiaoping's legacy, after all, and that's not something to be looked at lightly in China. In the Soviet and Russian context, this is an area of continuity between Soviet foreign policy and Russian foreign policy, because I would argue that the rapprochement began in the late Brezhnev era and flourished in the Gorbachev period and then really took root under Yeltsin and now today with Putin and Medvedev. Next, if we look at the foreign policy concepts of both countries, the strategic partnership figures prominently in terms of how they define their goals. And I don't have time to go into this, but if you look at Chinese foreign policy doctrines, many of the practices of the Sino-Russian partnership have flowed very much from these doctrines. And similarly for Russia, if you look at the July 2008 foreign policy concepts, it's clearly stated that the strategic partnership is based on common fundamental approaches to key issues of world politics, just as Gil mentioned. But, of course, there are divergent interests that are expressed in a number of areas, as we have heard from previous speakers, even in areas where you would expect cooperation, like Central Asia, and particularly on key issues that they claim to agree on, such as opposing separatism, as we saw in the case of the Georgian crisis, which didn't bring China and Russia together as one might have thought it would. And even on the Taiwan issue, which is one of the fundamental points on which all Sino-Russian agreements have to agree. There have been some divergences, which I can talk about later. So you do have a number of policy differences, and you also have continued sensitivity about the relationship itself. I was just in Shanghai in January for a conference on Cold War history and Sino-Soviet Cold War history. And this proved to be a very hot topic for both countries. For one thing, the Ministry of Education, after delaying the conference several times, refused to approve holding it on the campus of the university that organized it. And so the organizers, being ingenious, decided to move the conference off campus and hold it anyway. And so we went to this conference, and there was a Russian archivist who came and told us that archival access to documents on Sino-Soviet history was much more open in China than in Russia because of the political constraints placed on these materials in Russia. In China, the 25-year rule applies, so you have documents up to 1965 being declassified, at least for Chinese scholars. So the relationship continues to be sensitive, talking about its problems as well as its achievements. And there are a number of sources of distrust, which we heard about the regional level because of the demographic imbalance and Russian perceptions of it, or politically motivated uses of those perceptions, which have led to a slowdown in Russian development in the region, which creates a vicious cycle of distrust about Chinese intentions there. In terms of the military relationship, we didn't talk too much about that. That's been a key aspect of the trade tie between the two countries, but there are problems there with declining military sales in recent years because of Russian concerns about infringements of intellectual property, long-term threat planning issues. Energy was also supposed to be a cornerstone of the Sino-Russian relationship, and there have been a lot of problems there. How much should Russia depend on the Chinese market? For the Chinese side, is Russia really a reliable energy partner, considering many pipeline projects have been discussed for decades and still not implemented? And so the result of all this is what the Chinese call the problem of hot politics and cold economics, where you have, and the Russians agree with this characterization, that you have a lot of progress in terms of political declarations, statements of intention, but when you get down to it, it's very difficult to implement this partnership. However, if we look on the multilateral level, we see a mixed picture. We do see some areas of cooperation that are important for the West to pay attention to. And I think one primary arena for this is the UN. Because here, you do see where Chinese and Russian worldviews coincide. It does matter in the Security Council in terms of their positions on sanctions, in terms of the Iran issue, on Sudan, on Zimbabwe, in terms of human rights issues. And so there, Russia and China, perhaps we can discuss why they have these positions, but their views about non-interference in domestic affairs, a reluctance to use sanctions, have obstructed U.S. and other Western initiatives in some ways, or promoted an alternative vision of these policies. Then if we look at global economic organizations, such as the G8, you see some apparent agreement between Russia and China, but you have some posturing by each side. Russia would like to keep its privileged position in the G8, and China, while on the one hand staking out its position in the developing world, also sometimes gripes about Russia's presence in the G8 and China not being involved. For example, at the time of the 2006 summit that Russia held, there was some commentary in the Chinese media about how Russia was really a developing country and why it was hosting this meeting just because it had no relevance otherwise. So you do have a little bit of sour grapes from the Chinese side, although they benefit from being outside of this grouping too. Coming to regional organizations like the SCO, I think that this organization has some importance in terms of defining a vision of regional order, especially one that where the two big powers, China and Russia, agree on creating a framework that limits democratic regime change. And I think that does have an impact in terms of the way the region develops politically. It also has had a big influence on China's foreign policy development, because this is the first instance where China has been very involved in a multilateral regional organization, and some of the concepts that created the SCO are echoed in Hu Jintao's view of the harmonious world. So it's kind of a practice ground for a bigger aspect of Chinese foreign policy, I think. Nonetheless, there are fundamental differences in the way they approach Central Asia, with Russia preferring to work through CIS institutions such as the CSTO and fearing that regional integration within the SCO would only benefit China. China has wanted to focus on economic integration within the SCO because it sees this as an important way of integrating its own lagging Western provinces, especially Xinjiang, where it has security concerns, into the broader economy. And also creating a new energy industry centered in Xinjiang that would be drawing on resources from Central Asia. Also, there are some fundamental differences about crucial policy areas in this region. For example, separatism. The SCO's three important goals are combating separatism, terrorism, and extremism. And what we saw this summer with the Georgian crisis is that it's not so clear what separatism means to China and Russia. Because 2 days after Russia recognized South Ossetia and Abkhazia, the SCO met, and China played an important role in preventing that group from saying anything positive about Russian actions in Georgia. And the statement that was issued mentioned, in fact, the principle of territorial integrity and urged the parties to resolve matters peacefully. And so this was not what Russia was expecting of its strategic partner. And even the CSTO, where China is not a member, didn't recognize the independence of Abkhazia and South Ossetia, although it did support Russia more. Finally, on the economic crisis, here again is an area where you see some opportunity for China-Russia partnership, but also some downsides. There has been some talk about a China-Russia alternative model. However, there might not be very much substance in this, but there has it at least. What this reflects is the decline in American soft power because of the crisis at hand. At Davos, both Russia and China criticized the U.S. model for being unsustainable. But they're in different positions, because Russia is much more exposed to this crisis, is facing zero growth in the coming year, has had major economic problems beginning in May because of some actions by the Russian government against foreign and domestic companies, and then the Georgian crisis. So it's facing the need to pump billions of rubles into support the currency and to the banks. China's banks so far are not so vulnerable to this crisis, although they may be vulnerable to other things. But China's very much concerned in terms of loss of exports, unemployment, possible instability. And so together, they're very much concerned about coming out of this crisis. For China, this has been an opportunity, because China has cash to spend. And so China has been going around looking for deals where they extend loans in exchange for energy deals. And one big one that resolves an important problem in Russia-China relations had to do with the East Siberian pipeline, which had been stuck because of a financing issue last fall. And recently, Chinese extended a $25 billion loan to two Russian companies, Rosneft, the state oil company, and Transneft, the state pipeline organization, to finally build the remaining spur from Skavorodino into the Chinese border, and then China would build a pipeline to its own territory. And so this deal would provide considerable amount of oil to China in the coming years if it is completed. And Kazakhstan apparently is contemplating a similar kind of deal with China. So for China, this is an opportunity. For Russia and China together, it might be more problematic because their trade balance is likely to fall as Russian energy and other imports fall in the short term and with the decline in the price of oil. So I just conclude here that I think that there are strengths and then there are weaknesses to this partnership. And, you know, even though it's true that there's a considerable amount of distrust and there have been many problems, it's been very slow to get cooperation going, but I still think that they're, you know, for historical reasons and for doctrinal reasons, the two countries do set a great deal of store by one another, and that this relationship is something that we in the West need to pay attention to because it does affect us in terms of global energy policies. It affects us in terms of what happens in Central Asia. It affects us in terms of what happens in the United Nations. Thank you very much.
Well, it's always good to get three very different points of view. And I think that you have seen that with our three speakers here today. I want to ask one question of Dr. Law, since I know that you have another commitment later this evening, London time. You said that there is no alternative economic order and that the shift to the East has been overstated. I wonder if you think that, again, with the decline of the Western model, at least in terms of perception that has taken place over the past few years, and especially at this particular moment in time when you see a lot of countries going to China and asking for things. The United States is asking for China to buy a lot of U.S. treasuries. Other countries have similar deals that they are trying to pursue. Does that mean that China is going to be reaching more openly for great power status? And if they do that, don't they have to have a sort of rhetoric to go along with that that may highlight some of the aspects of what they perceive as their model, i.e., sort of double-digit economic growth, less emphasis on political reform, obviously not adopting any sort of political liberalism. And if China does that, might Russia also sort of look to play that game as well? If they do that, what are the implications for the attractiveness of that model for other developing countries?
That's a very rich question. I think one of the problems with this, with the idea of a so-called alternative economic model, is you have to ask yourself, well, what form would this alternative economic model take and who would lead it? Now, the problem, I think the goal, well, I would almost say the infamous Goldman Sachs 2003 report on the BRICS tended to lump Brazil, Russia, India, China as the great emerging powers, almost implying that they were really more or less going to be on the same level. In fact, it seems to me that it's China and India, which are the genuinely emerging powers, and Russia, although emerging in its own way, is far less of an emerging power in a global sense. So if we were talking about an alternative economic model, this would be one, let's say, hypothetically, that would be led by China. And this is something that would cause the Russians an enormous difficulty. Because the Russians find it's bad enough to be secondary to the West, but it's very, very tough to accept the reversal in fortunes in the relationship. In 1991, when the Soviet Union collapsed, it seemed that it was Russia that was going to go onwards and upwards, and China was still suffering from the sort of the kickback after Tiananmen in June 1989. So, and yet it's China which has had this remarkable transformation, and Russia, which has had tremendous problems. It's a very, very difficult thing for Russians psychologically handle. Since we're talking about history, the Russians, from almost the entire period of their relationship, sort of the last 300 years in particular, the Russians have been accustomed to being the dominant player in the relationship. Now suddenly they are the secondary, the second player in the relationship. Psychologically, very, very difficult. Historically, history actually makes them less flexible on this. Now, it's certainly true that the United States has taken a tremendous shock, that people around the countries around the world, not just Russia and China, but actually many of the Europeans, are questioning the American economic model. They're questioning the nature of international financial institutions that have been led and dominated by the United States. But this does not mean to say that they want to create a radically alternative, in a sense, an economic model driven by the so-called shift in power to the East. I don't see any evidence of that. And that brings us to what China wants. What does China want? Really, Jiang Zemin, in 2002, spoke about China's 20-year window of strategic opportunity. Basically, the Chinese want to be allowed to get on with it. In fact, since we're talking about Deng Xiaoping a lot here, it was Deng who said, you know, hide your strength, really conceal your intentions. Because the idea is that really the Chinese want to become a great power, in a sense, by stealth. It's not only that they talk about a harmonious world because they think that provides the optimum conditions for China's domestic transformation, but it's also because they believe that if you are up front and center, if you are spouting the rhetoric of a global great power, it has a natural, it causes a natural reaction among others to stop you. Already China feels the sort of cold winds of envy by the Europeans, that the Europeans are thinking, well, China should take on more responsibilities. China should behave, become a responsible stakeholder. In a sense, China recognizes that it has to become more of a responsible global stakeholder, but it's not yet prepared to take global responsibilities. While its conduct to foreign policy is more assured, it's still not a fully confident global player. And this is what really distinguishes it from Russia. Whereas Chinese prefer to walk the walk, the Russian emphasis is very much talking the talk. Thank you.
I'd like to open it up for questions. Please do use the microphone.
Thank you. I'm Cynthia Roberts from Hunter College and Columbia University. Quick comment and then a question. Thank you for three wonderful presentations. For Bobolo, I agree with your much of your remarks. Just a quick comment on the BRICS. I'm editing a journal issue on this very question, and I completely agree with what you've said, but it makes it all the more interesting that it's been Russia, not China, not Brazil, and not India, that's been in the forefront of trying to turn this BRIC idea into an actual diplomatic initiative, precisely because they feel so vulnerable, have no partners, no friends, and are looking everywhere for every opportunity, although maybe the Obama administration is presenting one for them now. My question, though, is on the domestic politics of this, not so much the identity or ideological issue. And here, I know the Russia case a lot better than the China case, where I'm more a consumer of information. And I wonder whether you see, both you, Bobolo, and Liz, and Gil Rosman, any kind of tipping point that would shift this relation closer, because I think it's correct to conceive it as principally one of a relationship to varying degree, but with a lot of competition in energy, in Central Asia, in politics, in economics, in military issues, and so on, and a lot of mistrust. But on the Russia side, for example, there are key domestic groups that strongly support it. And Liz mentioned the recent energy deal. We had the vice premier Session going to China to negotiate this. China is clearly in a strong position with so much economic reserves. But in Russia, despite the fact you can find people in the Genstab and the general staff that have a lot of fear and a lot of intellectuals who understand this relationship in the long run is against them, Nonetheless, there are also very strong supporters of it in military-industrial complex, the Siloviki, and within the Kremlin. I have less of a sense for that in the China area, and I wonder if Liz wants to correct my reading of it or add to it on, or both of you, perhaps, or all three of you on the Russia side. Thank you.
You asked two questions. One was about the tipping point, and the other was about the domestic pressures.
Well, then one could lead to the other.
Domestic tipping points.
Yes, could be
okay. Okay.
Well,
I think it's hard to say, you know, in general. It's a very hard question to answer. But I'll just tell you a little bit about the energy piece, because I've been working on that more closely. One of the times I was in China doing interviews, I talked to people in both Russian and Chinese oil companies, asking them about the future of Russia-China energy cooperation. And to my surprise, it was the Russians who were most optimistic and the Chinese who were the most pessimistic and frustrated. And so I think that it's hard to say in the abstract where the pressures are going to come from. I think there's a lot of interaction in this partnership, and sometimes it goes better than other times. But I think there's, you know, in the China case, there's a long-term commitment to energy cooperation with Russia, but there's also a sense that there are a lot of problems in that respect. And so I think partly, as a reaction to all these problems, China embarked on a global energy policy because they had first thought that they would center their energy policy on Russia. And then when that proved to be very slow going, then they developed this global strategy. So I think China's approach is more to have many options, to have a priority on this partnership, but to also have many options. I think a major tipping point would be some disastrous development in U.S.-China relations, I mean, in terms of bringing the two of them closer together. But barring that, I think China is committed to its independent foreign policy.
We should note that there was the recent incident between the U.S. and China, related to the Chinese claiming a little bit more naval space. I believe it was in the South China Sea. Again, too early to tell if that's going to be the harbinger of a longer term, more aggressive approach by the Chinese Navy, but it is there. Gil, do you want to?
Yes. I don't think domestically we're going to see some struggle for power that's going to lead to a tipping point of improving relations, unless we see the external stimulus for this. That's what seems to me operating. And I, for instance, examining the North Korean nuclear crisis, regard that as a potential stimulus. What I see happening is that the U.S. will turn to North Korea, to China, to try to find pressure against North Korea not to continue with its nuclear programs. Oh, negotiations may pick up again in the six-party talks, but I would assume that North Korea will try to maintain its nuclear force, and that there won't be an agreement, and the U.S. will try to get, will have, China will water down sanctions. China and Russia will work together to limit the U.S. influence. Russia more energetically, more angrily, China somewhat more cleverly, but both of them will together limit the U.S. role in forcing North Korea to give up. Then the question is, what does the U.S. do? Can we pressure China? I see some, Iran is another case where that could happen. I see a potential for real deterioration under those circumstances. Academics in China, as they did 3 years ago when the nuclear test occurred, will argue that the U.S. relationship is too important, China should cooperate with the U.S., and China will do to a slight degree. But the leaders will be largely insensitive to that, as they have been to other academic arguments of this sort, and the result will be a widening tension, Russia enjoying the fact that China-U.S. tensions widen. And so my outcome for this possible scenario is very different. I don't see in the next 5 to 10 years any relaxation of the concerns about U.S. power being excessive and China and Russia working together. And that, to me, is a pretty long time frame, 10 years. And so I think we're in a very dangerous world. There are going to be provocations, and the outcome of those provocations will test this strategic triangle, which Russia very much values, and I think China regards Russia as the most important country for its strategic interests other than the United States to help it versus the United States, and it will do nothing to marginalize Russia, to jeopardize that relationship in this time period. Of course, in the long term, Sino-Russian differences do widen.
Bobo, do you want to respond on that?
Yeah. Let's look at domestic pressures, domestic constituencies, and tipping points. For example, in Russia, there are various domestic constituencies that are certainly in favor of good relations with China. In fact, it's arguable that there is no constituency in Russia that doesn't believe in, at the very least, in a functional relationship with Beijing. Because it's a classic adage of hold your friends close, hold your enemies even closer. Really, it's something that they need. I think even the most rabid nationalist or arch-liberal westernizer in Moscow believes that, well, China, it's a global fact of life. You have to adapt to China's rising power, and you have to do it in as non-confrontational way as possible. So nobody would really question the importance of a stable, functional relationship with China. Where the domestic constituencies, I think, differ is that the liberals, for example, believe that China ultimately does pose a long-term threat. That's also a very, very common view in the Russian Far East, on the front line, so to speak. A lot of military people feel that while the West poses a more immediate strategic threat in the sense of sort of encroachment, so-called encroachment on the former Soviet space, it's China which poses the long-term existential threat. On tipping points, well, I think the classic tipping point would be, for example, since you mentioned this, the Navy incident, but what if there were a deterioration of U.S.-China relations over Taiwan, more generally? I think in that case, the Russians, far from coming to support China, would make themselves conspicuous by their absence. The Russians want no part of a major standoff between Beijing and Washington, and they've shown that. And it's very interesting, for example, that in the peace original venue for the peace mission 2005 military exercises was supposed to be actually in the area that we would think called the Nanjing Military District. And the Russians put a lot of pressure on the Chinese and insisted that they move it far further north to Shandong Peninsula and Vladivostok because they saw it as a provocative act. They want no part. They don't want that kind of strategic commitment in the same way that the Chinese don't want the relations with Russia to spoil their relations with the United States. So the Russians, of all constituencies, don't want too close an embrace with China to undermine their, again, more important relationships with Europe and the United States. I think it's important to remember that the Russians, they proceed from an indigenous imperial tradition, a Eurocentric, a European historical civilizational heritage, and an America-centric strategic culture. Now, of course, China is important in that, but it's all about the relative importance. And for Russia, for all Russians, the West is, and particularly the United States, is the first choice. You only have to see the renewed Russian interest in Obama's proposals, because the Russians feel, at last someone's recognizing our value. Because Barack Obama has emphasized not just the global financial crisis, but strategic arms control, Iran, Afghanistan. These are all issues where Russia is undoubtedly, not just a figment of its imagination, but is undoubtedly a frontline player. In fact, arguably the dominant other. And this is where is China? China is a bit player. This, I think it's really important to understand that the Russian worldview is so, if we're talking again about history and culture and civilization and normative values, The Russian worldview is formed by its relationship with the West. Now, this Western centrism doesn't mean pro-Westernism. It's very different. But it means that you take the West for all your key strategic points of reference.
Thank you very much for your interesting comments. My name is Dr. Polner. I teach at John Jay Around the Corner, and I'm also president of Cinema Verite International, Inc. I worked in the Russian Far East. I worked in Yuzhno-Sakhalin and in Khabarovsk. And while I was there, there were constant complaints from the various Westerners that they were having a very rocky road with Russia. And Russia was always changing, literally from a day and night. And so I would imagine that the Chinese are well aware of that at this point. And I would imagine that they would be questioning how their further negotiations with Russia in respect to oil will go. Thank you very much.
I'll make some good comments then. I've been to the Russian Far East three times in the last 5 years, and they do create a great deal of concern about reliability. The Chinese have suffered from that too. The Chinese have been more successful in working out arrangements. Their trade has increased much more with that area. The area is far more dependent on China, despite their fears, anxieties, their yellow peril discussions. And I think that's part of the picture. Russian anxieties are real, but where do they really go? Who do they point to more? China? Historically, yes. Or the United States with its role in Ukraine and Georgia and values pushing, whereas China doesn't push any values towards Russia? It seems to me it's clear that for the last few years, Putin has said China's minor, even though earlier he had a different calculation, and the United States is really major, and this is Western centrism only in the sense it's Slavophilism that challenges the U.S. and the West as a danger to Russian civilization. I don't think that goes away because they get some negotiations with Obama, which they are eager for, which won't lead to solutions about some of the big problems because the differences are so fundamental, and we will end up with both China and Russia saying we need each other in this difficult and maybe even increasingly dangerous climate.
Yeah, Liz, please.
I've also spent a lot of time in the Russian Far East, and I think that over there there's a, because of the concerns, some real and some exaggerated, about Chinese intentions there has been a preference for economic partnerships with Western countries, with the United States, with Japan, with South Korea. But these countries have gotten frustrated about the conditions of working in the Russian Far East, and so cooperation has not moved along as swiftly. And so China has been the partner that they have had to turn to more by necessity than by choice often. And for China, even though they also feel frustrated with dealing with Russians in that part of the country, for them it's a domestic matter, because they have to deal with the development of their northeastern provinces, which have lagged behind the coastal areas, have faced big unemployment problems, and so they've been trying to generate some economic activity to help those areas. And so China has stuck with the Russian Far East as an economic partner, even though they're incredibly frustrated also, especially with the difference in attitudes. Because for China, they see a win-win situation. They see China needing resources, having labor, and Russia having land and resources. Why not cooperate? But for Russia, that's anathema. That breeds all the fears that Bobolo was talking about earlier. And so they tend to see it in zero-sum terms. If China gains anything, somehow it's bad for Russia. So what that has done is it's created a lag in the development of the Russian Far East relative to the Chinese side of the border. So if you go to Blagoveshchensk, for example, in the Russian Far East, and you look across the Amur River, you see the high-rises in Heihe in China, but you're standing in a city that's essentially unchanged since the 19th century. And they've been talking for years about building a bridge across the river and have not yet put a stone in that project because of all the concerns about the hordes of Chinese who would cross that bridge, even if the bridge would lead to a lot of economic development. So these problems are partly the real issues of economic interaction in the Russian Far East, but they're also partly perceptual.
Yeah, thank you. Professor Rosman really does put, has hit the crux of the problem, really, in the Russian Far East. The problem in the Russian Far East is not that the Russians hate the Chinese or like them. It's the fact that it's an extraordinarily ambivalent relationship. Again, this is what I tried to convey in my book, and that's what I've tried, perhaps unsuccessfully, to convey in my comments today. The Russian people living in the Russian Far East know that they depend on the Chinese. That it's certainly true that trade is booming relative to the rest of the Russian Federation. In terms of effective inter-regional cooperation, it's an example in the relationship, definitely. And yet, people in the Russian Far East know that they, to a large extent, depend on the Chinese. But do you think that makes them grateful? Do you think that makes them say, oh, look, we're really pleased? But in fact, no. The real problem for them is that they still think, oh, well, we hate being so dependent. I mean, it's a classic thing, almost a sort of culture of envy, you know, this a storied feature of Soviet and Russian life, that you hate being grateful to someone because it means that you're in their debt. And what the people in the Russian Far East, they hate the fact that Moscow neglects them. They hate the fact that they are ruled, especially in places like Primorsky Krai, their local government is appalling. They hate the fact that their economy, regional economies, are so dysfunctional, but they hate the fact that they're so dependent on the Chinese. On the one hand, they think, yes, the Chinese workers, they're hardworking, they're sober, and don't we hate them for their virtue? And that's, hate is a strong word, but resentment, perhaps. Now, Professor Rosman is right. I mean, Russia definitely does have genuine anxiety about the West, about the United States. But these anxieties, I would argue, are not, when it comes down to it, fundamentally existential. It's not that the United States is going to somehow generate the breakup of Russia. It's Russia particularly wants from the United States is respect. It's uvazhenie. They want to be given their due as a great global power, and they feel that the United States, rightly or wrongly, you may think, has not given given Russia its due. The difference with China is this. Putin, of course, will say nice things about China because, let's face it, he doesn't really have a lot of options. Because if you ask yourself, what major powers are actually friends or even, let's use a term, strategic partners to Russia? There are very, very few. I think it's highly significant that President Medvedev, in his first overseas visit, went to China and Kazakhstan because those two countries are, frankly, the nearest things that he has to strategic partners and friends. Now, I think there's a difference also. Professor Rosman raised the issue of Slavophilism. Being a Slavophile doesn't mean you're Asia-centric. It means you're Russia-centric. It means that you're looking at intrinsic Russian values. It means, yes, you kick back against the West, but it also is a resentment of, in a way, the Mongol heritage as well. I completely concur with Elizabeth Wishnick's comments about the stark contrast between Russia and China along the border. It's not only the difference between Heihe and Blagoveshchensk, but it's actually differences along either side of the border. And the Russians themselves acknowledge that. Just very quickly on energy, it's very interesting. I mean, Elizabeth Wishnick mentioned the Chinese diversifying. Yes, they have. It's extraordinary. In 1989, China had 5 external suppliers of its oil imports. By 2005, this had expanded to 32. The big complaint that the Chinese have about the Russians over their energy relationship is, to quote a very, very senior official in the National Development Reform Commission, the Russians are more interested in geopolitical games playing than they are in serious energy cooperation. Thank you.
I'm Lenny Venorda from OSI. Thank you, Tom. Just a quick comment and then a question, if I can. On the comment side, it's been very useful to hear about your discussion on perceptions, because we speak about that very little. When we talk about Russia and China, we speak so often about institutions, very little about perceptions. This is very useful. I would say a couple of years ago, we were having a conversation here with Garry Kasparov, who was on his way to the Far East. And I asked him, what were his talking points? He was going to 5 or 6 different cities to kind of proselytize for democracy in Russia. And I said, Garry, I'm curious to hear what you're going to sort of underscore. And he said, well, you know, free and fair elections, human rights, independent media, and, of course, the yellow peril. And this seems sort of astounding that this, for him, was part of the package that he was going to be transmitting to the Far East, that this was something that the people on the ground would accept and imbibe in some sort of positive way and make his whole package of kind of, you know, democratic advancement coherent. Anyhow, my question, though, deals, though, on the human rights side, which we haven't really discussed at all. Certainly rights advocates, and not only they, were quite taken aback by Hillary Clinton a couple of weeks ago, who certainly did not place primacy in her conversation with China about human rights, and in fact very much put it on the back burner. At the same time, we know that in Russia, few things angered Russians more than sort of the human rights question over the last few years. My colleague Chris from Freedom House is here today, and he will be sort of first in line to make the claim that certainly Freedom House does not have a great reputation today because of the fact that they spent the last number of years talking about Russia as a solidly authoritarian state. Now, I'm wondering about the rights question, whether there is any coherence between China and Russia on the ideology side with respect to thinking about human rights from a more realist vantage point. Russia talks about sovereign democracy. China talks about alternative forms of liberal democracy. Maybe human rights doesn't fit into that worldview, and that is, in fact, something that might be ultimately a virtue for those two states.
The antagonism towards Western approaches to human rights on the part of the leadership of these two countries and their political elites is palpable. They regard it as a smokescreen for containment and for other nasty purposes. And to start strategically to improve relations with these countries, it is not a bad idea to emphasize where we can build a better foundation and approach human rights in the context of a foundation that's already established, particularly when we face such urgent problems today. It does not mean that we should downgrade human rights as our issue, and they should always be aware of it, but that to how to handle it matters. And I would say perceptions, for me, you say they haven't been given enough attention. Well, I've been working so much on perceptions for the last 15 years of the 4 countries I work on, China, Japan, South Korea, and Russia, that people joke that my next project is the next country's perceptions of the other country. I haven't finished all 10 of those cases in the depth I'm supposed to. But my view is that we respond to a country's policies by understanding its perceptions and its debates. That means you figure out what would be effective. How do you reach a wider audience in that country? How do you build step-by-step relations? And so I regard China and Russia as cooperating and agreeing very much on human rights. It is a staple of their elite and official thinking. And it is a big challenge to try to overcome that. They will press this issue together, and it drives them closer.
I'd just like to add that I think sometimes that this is stated formally. For example, in 2001, the China and Russia signed a declaration, last year they signed a declaration on the inalienable aspect of security, which cannot be achieved at the expense of others. And although this was talking about security, the meaning was that you can't rearrange the internal politics of other countries to suit your security needs. And formally also within the SCO, this has been the framework for working in Central Asian region, that there should not be interference in the domestic politics of these states. And this is, again, that has a security aspect to it in terms of trying to limit U.S. influence in the region. But it also has it has implications, certainly for human rights, in terms of what happens there. But there's also an informal aspect which comes to bear in the way that Russia and China, especially China, provide development assistance to other countries, which is in stark contrast to the way that the West does, or the EU, the United States, or international organizations, and that's without having any kinds of strings attached, and which creates real difficulties. For example, in Africa, where if a country has a choice between a World Bank-supported project that has all kinds of human rights criteria and a Chinese development project that does not, which one will they choose? And the Russian development has a similar characteristic. And so even though they might not be coordinating, they might not agree on a common economic model, they do have certain kinds of development practices, I would say, that lead to an approach to human rights which is divergent from the one that we would like to see.
Can I sort of ask a small follow-up question on that? Given Lenny mentioned Hillary Clinton's recent visit to Asia and the fact that at least vis-a-vis China, human rights was not a major push. The primary issues of concern being, of course, cooperation on the economic crisis and global warming. I wonder if that means then that looking at these two countries, that there may be benefits to fostering links between individuals and groups inside the two countries that are working on some of these issues. So, for example, you have the problem of rising nationalism that we've touched on this panel discussion in both countries. Are there benefits to, trying to facilitate conversations between individuals and groups who are trying to combat rising nationalism in both countries to see if there are similar strategies that could be used? Problems on restriction of freedom of expression in both countries that have been widely discussed in both countries. Is there a benefit to bringing those people together? I don't hear that much conversation inside China about China's rather conservative approach to certain issues at the United Nations, but is there a benefit to bringing groups together to talk about that, given that Liz pointed out that this is an issue on which there is a strong bond between the two countries in terms of what they do here in New York? Any comments on that idea?
I think that would be a great idea in the environmental area, because China and Russia, among their many problems, the environment is one of them. If you remember the 2005 Songhuajiang chemical spill, where a chemical factory exploded and the Chinese didn't provide much information, and people in Khabarovsk were worried that their water supply was contaminated. So I think there are social groups in China and in Russia that are working on environmental issues with limited resources, and I think they share some of these goals. Everyone wants clean water, they want information. For China, it's very difficult. These groups face a lot of harassment and funding difficulties. But I think that there's actually a common interest. Mm-hmm. Public health also. If you look at the arc of where bird flu spread, it's all along the Russia-China, Central Asia border areas. And in China, the public health groups aren't as well established as in the environment. But that's an area also where you could presumably foster cooperation, or in issues of food and product safety. With the Russians, who first called attention to the problems with Chinese products, and the Russian Far East, because they were the place where they got all the low-end Chinese goods, and they complained about it for years. And now we get some of these goods too, and so we're more aware of this problem. But I think that's another area where you could develop cooperation, certainly.
Bobo, I see you wanting to chime in.
Yeah, just picking up a couple of points here. I completely agree with Professor Rosman on the sort of the smoke screen here. In fact, I think the issue isn't, though, so much of human rights. It's that human rights translates into interference into domestic affairs. And that's something that both Russia and China feel they have an interest in resisting. But it's interesting about common perceptions between Russians and Chinese about human rights, about democracy, because if you talk to most Russians, both general public and also within the political elite, they believe that they are normatively far closer to Europe than they are to, say, China or even in the non-West. They said that when Putin, before he became a president, said, "We are a central part of Western European civilization. Wherever Russians live, in the Far East, in the South, we are European." So they actually resent the idea that somehow they're thinking, Russian thinking on human rights, on democracy, on civil society is actually pretty approximate to that of the Chinese. On the Clinton visit to China, it's very interesting. I think the Chinese definitely see something like that as reflecting a more realist, hard-headed approach in Washington. And so do the Russians. But what's significant here is both with it's America's, if you like, awakening, or America's new realism. And that is the attraction there for Russia and China. Interesting, they're not so much looking at each other, but they're looking to the United States. They're trying to derive hope from a sort of a more positive, less obviously unilateral attitude in Washington. Elizabeth Wishnick raises a really interesting point, I think, about the sort of Songhua River, the public, Chinese public health issues, Chinese product safety issues. This is, for all the Russian admiration for China's economic growth and sort of transformation, modernization over the last 30 years, the Russians, there is still a large part of Russian thinking that still sees China as a little bit backward, somewhat uncivilized, somewhat unregulated. And in here, they actually draw a distinction between Japan, with whom they have a much more problematic political relationship, but they actually think that the Japan is almost what Russia would like to be, obviously with nukes, because Japan, in a sense, is a country which is modern, which has its own distinct identity, which is, in a way, part of the West, but not so part of the West that it's bound by the West. And Japan represents a sort of a technological sophistication. And the Chinese, with their product safety issues, public health, and lousy environment situation, actually represent a kind of world that Russians would like to feel that they are leading.
I'm Chris Walker at Freedom House. I thought since Lenny invoked Freedom House, I'd just share some thoughts. I'd first say that Freedom House findings have certainly found an erosion of democratic rights in Russia. And our findings also don't evaluate China so well under these indicators. But I'd also say that virtually every other organization that covers these sorts of issues, whether you talk about Human Rights Watch, talk about domestic groups that might still be able to operate in Russia today independently, they'd find similar conclusions. And I think if reasonable people sat down and had this conversation about whether the degree of competition in the electoral sphere, whether the opportunities for civil society to function openly in an unfettered way, whether the media can operate and investigate and talk about issues in an open way in today's Russia is better today than 5 years ago or 10 years ago even. I think reasonable minds might come to similar conclusions. It's not surprising that the regimes in these countries have different ways of characterizing this sort of an analysis. I think Dr. Lowe mentioned that human rights translates into interference in domestic affairs. That's certainly one level of analysis. I might offer another observation that leads to a question, which is, and I think it's been implicit in the comments of all the panelists, just hasn't been made explicit, and that is human rights and what extend from them in terms of democratic values, democratic standards, open media, political pluralism and competition, civil society, these are things that lead to political accountability and transparency. And I think if you look at, Liz Wishnick touched on this, what the Chinese government has done in international foreign institutions, at some level you might say they have a two-track policy. One is protecting the worst of the worst. So in the UN fora, you have the Burmas of the world, the North Koreas to some degree, the Zimbabwes that all get some sort of cover. The Russians will also participate in this. But there's a second tier that's emerged recently, which has also been touched on, which is the developing world. So you can look at East Asia. You have Cambodia, which gets increasing support from Chinese. You have any number of countries in sub-Saharan Africa that get infrastructure support. No strings attached. Depending how you look at it, you can say, well, there are no strings attached. I think another way to look at it is that by virtue of offering such enormous support and having it available as an option for conditional, that is to say, standards-based support that comes from Western NGOs, from Western governments, IFIs, it's also reducing accountability externally. I think if you look at what the Russians have done in the OSCE, the ODIHR, if you look at the UN, if you look at what Venezuela's done in the OAS, there's also an international dimension which, if you distilled all of this, you could say externally there's an exercise in, among other things, reducing accountability, but certainly domestically, when you kind of blow away all the smoke, the rhetoric, all these countries invoke the term democracy to describe themselves. I think it was Dmitry Trenin who said the sovereign democracy, somehow they emphasize the sovereign more than the democracy. I think that's at the heart of this. And I'd be curious, come back to an observation made by Dr. Rosman, and that was, he didn't think that the new administration, with its pragmatism and engagement, would be any more successful in Russia and China, which I found fascinating, because I think the conventional wisdom, at least in some quarters, was that once you got past the baggage and the approach of the last administration, it would offer a reset, as some might say, for engaging these countries. But you strongly suggested that the external approach, whether it's belligerent, whether it's unilateralist, or whether it's engaging and more realist in its character, won't be relevant in getting more positive policy outcomes with these countries. I'd be curious for your thoughts.
I wouldn't put it in as strong terms as you interpret it. I regard the Obama foreign policy as a important, necessary corrective to past policies, and I think in particular with Russia, it does help reset matters after great deterioration. China-Russia relations actually have been on a pretty good keel for a few years at the surface on issues where we have found common ground, and both sides say it's the best relationship since the normalization or even the Nixon trip. But I think what we're missing is what's going on beneath the surface in China. And so I would argue that Russia and the United wants to deal with the United States. But when push comes to shove, we won't find agreement on some of the critical issues. Maybe on control over missiles, long-distance missiles, new agreement there, maybe some other issues. But basically, Russia's main goals will be beyond what we can accept, and they've already indicated that by upping the stakes and increasing their military budget and in other respects. I think the same thing is true for China. Of course, the word democracy also was used with democratic centralism. And in both of these states, there is an obsession these days with the state and with building up comprehensive national power as an end in itself, and the state as the means to do that. And that makes the human rights discussion very difficult. Because in China, they emphasize they need a market economy for that and openness to the international economic integration. In Russia, they want to bring in all the domestic resources. And Medvedev, of course, has shifted the tone somewhat. But basically, the focus is so much on if the state is weak, we lose around the world, and we are unable to preserve order at home, that makes it hard for us to get a good human rights dialogue going.
Other comments? Liz.
I think I agree with Gil that it, on a formal level, this dialogue will be hard to initiate because of so many other priorities. But I think indirectly there might be some progress. And that's partly because of the focus on some other kinds of what I would call non-traditional security issues that seem to be a priority in the Obama administration, like climate change. And to the extent that the U.S. government is serious about raising climate change with China, I think that brings in new players in China who are pressing for accountability inside China and more transparency in terms of production methods and environmental conditions, bringing in groups, social groups who have a stake in that, and also creating more awareness that inspires citizen movements, that spontaneously develop citizen movements that arise over particular environmental issues. And so I think that there might be some spillover effect in terms of the Obama administration's choice of issues to engage China. And I also think there are some X factors, some variables we don't know. For example, what will happen to social stability in China in light of the economic crisis? By some estimates, 12% of university graduates may be unemployed. So what are all those thoughtful young people going to be doing while they're... They might be going to the internet cafe. You're telling me you have a big project on the internet that's coming into being. And so the internet plays an interesting role in China because it enables citizens to push the limits a little bit, and often there's some pushback by the government side. But it also creates a little bit of space there, text messaging and all other kinds of communication. So we don't really know how all of these factors are going to combine, the new issues that the Obama administration will put on the table, and then the uncertain economic climate, which might motivate citizens to take actions that are not very predictable.
Bobo, any comments?
It's interesting that we raised the name of Garry Kasparov. It's certainly true that Russia has... undergone a sort of an authoritarian trend, particularly during Putin's second presidential term. But let's not kid ourselves here. Russia remains, for all its illiberal tendencies, a far more open, liberal, and pluralist society and polity than China. There is no way that someone like Garry Kasparov, as outspoken as him, could function in China today. And yet he can, admittedly under real restrictions, but he can at least function and find a voice in Russia. It's a small voice, but at least he has much more flexibility in Russia than he would have in China. This raises, come back to Ben's question about sort of working with liberal groups in Russia and China. It's so difficult these days. I mean, they do struggle along, particularly that they struggle along in Russia because they have at least a glimmer of hope. But really, they are so marginalized, and the government and the Putin-Medvedev administration has been so tough on particularly politically related NGOs that really the future is actually, as Elizabeth Wishnick has suggested, you actually have to look at more social issues. And the same is particularly, is even more true actually in China. It is looking at environmental issues. You, in a sense, have to depoliticize. You know, so if you're going to deal with so-called more liberal groups or more progressive groups, then you have to do so, I think, in areas that are out of the direct political limelight. Now, on nationalism, it's quite interesting here. You know, the chairman mentioned suggesting the problem of nationalism in Russia, in China. The trouble with nationalism is it's not so much that we can do anything to engage with Moscow and Beijing to bring that level down, because really our influence on Russia and China is far less than we would perhaps like it to be. And indeed, nationalism is such an intrinsic part of Putin Medvedev's Russia, and I would argue it's an intrinsic part. In a sense, it's the new ideology of the Communist Party, because communist ideology as such has essentially been bankrupt. So nationalism is the Chinese Communist Party's major ideology, I would argue. I'd leave it at that.
Okay. I think we have time for one last question.
Samuel Song. My question is, several years ago, Hainan incident, aircraft incident, and more recently, Chinese submarine harassing U.S. reconnaissance operation. Last year, or 2 years ago, China-Russian military exercise from Qingdao to Siberia. Another issue has been U.S. Pacific Command had a joint naval exercise with the South Asian nations. Six of the nations have been ASEAN nations. Also, China is undoubtedly one of the largest U.S. trade partners. Having said that, how would you define, in one word, China is an adversary, trade partner, or whatever? I'd like to know that. Thank you.
Just to refresh people's memories, so the Hainan incident is the U.S. spy plane that was crashed into a Chinese plane that was sent out to intercept it. It led to the death of the Chinese pilot, and the plane did a crash landing on Hainan Island. The U.S. airmen that were on that plane were then held for a period of, I can't remember if it was several days or a few weeks before being released. That was a sort of moment of tension in the early years of the Bush administration that was then subsequently resolved. It's been largely forgotten, obviously, after 9/11, but it has been sort of brought up again with the recent submarine issue that the gentleman pointed to. Thoughts, Gil?
You want a one-word answer? Duality or hedging. Yeah. We live in a complicated world. China and the United States are extremely integrated in a lot of ways, and we're extremely competitive in other ways, and the military competition is growing tougher, and our differences about our right to gather intelligence in the economic zone around China and the Chinese belief that we have no such right are an indication of the struggles we're going to increasingly have in the years ahead.
Liz.
I have one word and one punctuation mark. It's going to be partner, question mark.
And Bobo.
I agree with Gil on hedging. If I were allowed one sentence, I would say the U.S. and China have a strategic relationship, but not a strategic partnership.
Well put, and a fantastic and scintillating discussion. I want to thank again all three of our panelists, and I want to thank all of you for some very invigorating questions. Thanks again.